London, the House of Commons, July the 29th, 1941, a speech on war production.
I have now described to the committee a number of solid factors which have arisen since the Dunkirk period, all of which have tended to obstruct and reduce output. I should like to give the committee some facts and figures to show how far we have succeeded by improved organization and by the smooth running of our expanding machinery in overcoming these adverse currents which I have set out at length. But here I encounter a new difficulty. I am told we cannot have these debates in secret session. They must be in public. The Germans must read in 2 or 3 days every word we say, and therefore I cannot give actual figures. In addition, I am told by my honorable friends to let us have none of these comparative percentages. Let us not be told that we are producing half as much again, or double what we produced this time last year, because we were producing nothing last year, or something like it. As my honorable friend said, it is a Lancashire saying that twice note is note. So, according to these critics, I am inhibited from all vindicatory comparisons. I must not say how much better we are at this time last year, when, after all, we had been at war for 10 or 11 months, and so were presumably making something. I must not say how much better we are than at the 23rd month of the last war, nor how our output compares with the peak of the last war, because it is contended conditions have changed. This is rather easy money for the critics. A handful of members can fill a couple of days' debate with disparaging charges against our war effort, and every ardent or disaffected section of the press can take it up, and the whole can cry a dismal, cacophonous chorus of stinking fish all round the world. But no answer must be made. Nothing must be said to show the giant war effort, the prodigy of national zeal, which excites the astonishment of friend and foe, which will command the admiration of history, and which have kept us alive. I defy these tyrannical prohibitions. I intend to make comparisons, both with the Dunkirk-Dakin period and with the similar and peak periods of the last war. Despite all the troubles I have enumerated, the Ministry of Supply output in the last 3 months has been one-third greater than the 3 months of the Dunkirk period. Though our Navy, Army and Air Force are larger, the Ministry has one-third more people working in its factories. Thus, despite dilutions, dispersion, reduced food, the blackout, and all the troubles I have described, each man is turning out on the whole each day as much as he did in that time of almost superhuman effort after Dunkirk. Let me present the balance sheet. One-third more workers and one-third more output is quit. But all the adverse factors I have described have somehow or other been cancelled out by superior development of our machinery and organization. We have made in the last 3 months more than twice the field guns we made in the Dunkirk period. The ammunition we are turning out is half as much again. The combined merchant and naval shipbuilding now in active progress is bigger, not only in scale, but in current daily volume of execution than it was at any period in the last war. And of course the work now is immeasurably more complex than it was then. We are told how badly labor is behaving. And then a lot of people who never did a day's hard work in their lives are out after them. Again, I claim, look back to the last war. In that war we had many bitter and devastating strikes, and in the final 2 years, nearly 12 million working days were lost through labor disputes. So far, in the whole 23 months of this war, we have lost less than 2 million days. I was anxious to have the latest information about trade disputes in the country. I received a few minutes before I rose to speak a report that at 11 o'clock there was no stoppage of work of any kind arising from a trade dispute in any part of Great Britain. It is the fashion nowadays to abuse the Minister of Labour. He is a workman, a trade union leader. He is taunted with being an unskilled labourer representing an unskilled union. I dare say he gives offence in some quarters. He has his own methods of speech and action. He has a frightful load to carry, yet a job to do which none would envy. He makes mistakes, as I do, though not so many or so serious. He has not the same opportunities. At any rate, he is producing at this moment, though perhaps on rather extensive terms, a vast and steady volume of faithful effort, the like of which has not been seen before. And if you tell me that the results he produces do not compare with those of totalitarian systems of government and society, I reply by saying, we shall know more about that when we get to the end of the story. I dare say that some of our critics will not like this kind of talk. They call it complacency. Living in comparative idleness, they wish to lash the toilers of body and mind to further exertions. To state facts which are true and encouraging is to be accused of cheap and facile optimism. Our critics do not like it. Neither do the Germans, though for different reasons. But I consider that if for days on end the whole national effort is disparaged and insulted, and if all over the world we are depicted by our friends and countrymen as slack, rotten, and incompetent, we are entitled, nay, it becomes a pressing duty, to restore the balance by presenting the truth. When I look out upon the whole tumultuous scene of this ever-widening war, I feel it my duty to conclude by giving a very serious warning to the House and to the country. We must be on our guard equally against pessimism and against optimism. There are no doubt temptations to optimism. It is the fact that the mighty Russian state, so foully and treacherously assaulted, has struck back with magnificent strength and courage, and is inflicting prodigious and well-deserved slaughter for the first time upon the Nazi armies. It is the fact that the United States, the greatest single power in the world, is giving us aid on a gigantic scale and advancing in rising wrath and conviction to the very verge of war. It is the fact that the German air superiority has been broken and that the air attacks on this country have for the time being almost ceased. It is the fact that the Battle of the Atlantic, although far from won, has, partly through American intervention, moved impressively in our favor. It is the fact that the Nile Valley is now far safer than it was 12 months ago or 3 months ago. It is the fact that the enemy has lost all pretense of theme or doctrine and is sunk ever deeper in moral and intellectual degradation and bankruptcy, and that almost all his conquests have proved burdens and sources of weakness. But all these massive, towering facts which we are entitled to dwell on must not lead us for a moment to suppose that the worst is over. The formidable power of Nazi Germany, the vast mass of destructive munitions they have made or captured, the courage, skill, and audacity of their striking forces, the ruthlessness of their centralized war direction, the prostrate condition of so many great peoples under their yoke, the resources of so many lands which may to some extent become available to them, all these restrain rejoicing and forbid the slightest relaxation. It would be madness for us to suppose that Russia or the United States is going to win this war for us. The invasion season is at hand. All the armed forces have been warned to be at concert pitch by the 1st of September, and to retain the utmost vigilance meanwhile. We have to reckon with a gambler's desperation. We have to reckon with a criminal who by a mere gesture has decreed the death of 3 or 4 million Russian and German soldiers. We stand here still the champions. If we fail, all fails. And if we fall, all will fall together. It is only by a superb, intense and prolonged effort of the whole British Empire that the great combination of about 3/4 of the human race against Nazism will come into vehement and dynamic life. For more than a year we have been all alone. All alone we have had to guard the treasure of mankind. Although there have been profound and encouraging changes in the situation, our own vital and commanding responsibilities remain undiminished, and we shall discharge them only by continuing to pour out in the common cause the utmost endeavors of our strength and virtue, and if need be, to proffer the last drop of our heart's blood.